Pete Weston and his other corporate lawyers to argue with the Soviets, the UN, and Hernandez's Venezuelans. While they talked, Dan acted. Nobuhiko Yamagata was a Soviet prisoner. Dan could not allow that. He was responsible for Nobu. It wasn't that Saito would blame him for Nobu's danger. The youngster had been eager for the asteroid mission, no matter what the risks. But Dan felt personally responsible for his old friend's son. There was no escaping that. It was his fault that Nobu and the others were being held prisoners at Luna Grot. And Dan Randolph met his responsibilities, paid his debts, one way or the other. He had sailed the sloop directly to the launching center on the man-made island off La Guaira and ordered a helicopter to fly Lucita back to her beach club. "Tell your father what's happened," he commanded Lucita, although I suspect he already knows. "Tell him that I expect the government of Venezuela to protest in the strongest possible terms. There are 4 Venezuelan citizens among the crew of Dolphin 1. "But what was the spacecraft doing so far away from Earth?" she asked, confused. "I'm sending a man around to explain the whole mission to him. It was a private venture of Astro Manufacturing, but there were Venezuelan nationals on board." He bundled her onto the helicopter after getting one of the women from the administration center to find a pair of coveralls that Lucita could put on over her skimpy bikini. As the helicopter clattered off, Dan dashed back to the administration building and began asking his best and most experienced astronauts to volunteer for a rescue mission. And Njombe was the first man he asked. The big black man stared goggle-eyed when he heard what Dan had in mind.
"Raid Luna Grot and get the men back? That's crazy.
You have a better suggestion? The Soviets have 8 of our men. They're going to try them for piracy. Piracy! Double goddammit to hell, they're threatening to hang them."
"They can't do that," Njombe said.
"They're not going to get the chance to.
We're snatching them back, and you're going to help me do it."
The big Angolan started to frown, but it came out smiling.
"Not me. I'm not crazy."
"I thought those men were your friends," Dan snapped. "Vargas, Carstairs, they'd come through for you if you needed help, wouldn't they?"
"That's not fair, boss."
"Since when have I been fair? It's an unfair universe, friend." Scowling, Njombe said reluctantly,
"All you're going to accomplish is getting more of us taken prisoner by the Russians."
"We're going to need 5 or 6 others," Dan said. Njombe started to say,
"I'll pick..."
"No, I'll pick them," Dan snapped. "I'm leading this mission, and I'll pick the team."
"You're going yourself?"
Dan felt surprised that Njombe would think otherwise.
"Certainly."
The Angolan broke into a grin.
"Shouldn't be any trouble getting 6 men to go with you. After all, if the boss gets himself killed, who's going to sign the paychecks?"
They had shuttled up to Nueva Venezuela that night after several hours of computer runs to check out the best way to implement Dan's plan. With barely an hour's layover, 7 astronauts, led by Dan himself, left the space station packed aboard a single needle-shaped flitter. But instead of going to the factory, they angled off on a high-energy boost to one of the empty Soviet ore carriers plying its way placidly back to Luna Grot. Boarding the empty freighter had been easy. Now they waited for it to land under remote command from the controllers at Luna Grot on the royal, dusty surface of the moon. Their flitter rode behind them with no one left in it except Goldman, whose job was to put the spacecraft in orbit around the moon and stay there until Dan brought the rest of the crew and the captives up to him. The flitter coasted in the radar shadow of the big spherical freighter, but Dan knew that once the freighter started its descent and Goldman moved their spacecraft into a moon-circling orbit, it would become immediately visible to the Soviet radars at Luna Grot.
"Have you thought about what Goldman's going to do if they start shooting at him?" Njombe asked.
With nothing to do except hover inside the dark interior of the freighter's vast spherical cargo hold, waiting for the giant eggshell of a spacecraft to touch down on the moon, Dan and his team had plenty of time to worry over every detail.
"No anti-satellite weapons at Luna Grot,"
said Coctins, the lanky, wild-haired Latvian engineer who had left the Soviet Union for a vacation in Sweden 4 years earlier and never returned. Dan recognized his heavily accented English. In their spacesuits, they were almost indistinguishable from one another except for gross differences in size. The names stenciled on their suit chests had all been painted over.
"No weapons?" Njombe sounded unconvinced. "You're certain?"
"No anti-satellite weapons," repeated Coctins.
"Guns for shooting people, plenty."
"Hey, that's a big load off my mind," wisecracked Elger, the smallest of the 6 and the only woman among them. Goldman's safe is in bed. The only guns they got are for us.
She had literally fought her way onto the team, taking one of the male astronauts in two straight Aikido falls when he had challenged her fitness for the mission. Most of the astronauts had eagerly volunteered to help rescue their friends from Luna Grot once they knew that Dan was going. He had been surprised by their fervor.
"What I could never figure out," said O'Leary, "is why the Ruskies use these stupid freighters. Why don't they just catapult the oars off the moon?"
"You mean with a mass driver?" Njombe asked.
"An electric catapult system, yeah."
"That's the way we would do it," Dan said. "It's cheaper and more efficient, but the Russians aren't worried about cost or efficiency. Somebody in their bureaucracy must have written a memo about the safety hazards of flinging bucket loads of dirt off the lunar surface and having them flying around between the moon and the space stations."
"But they'd move along perfectly predictable trajectories, just like any spacecraft."
Dan shook his head inside his helmet. "Astronomical laws and common sense don't count with bureaucrats. Only rules and regulations. And memos," Elger added. "The longer and harder to read, the more points you earn."
"It's stupid," O'Leary said.
"Not altogether," countered Njombe. "These craters are powered by rockets that burn powdered aluminum and oxygen, both obtained from the lunar soil. It's almost as cheap as an electric catapult system would be."
"Not by a factor of 10, I'll bet," said O'Leary.
Dan let them debate. They were talking out their nervousness. He had gotten them to volunteer quickly before they could really think about the risks involved. Now, with nothing to do but wait, the realities of this mad escapade were catching up with them. And with Dan. There were 1,000 ways this mission could go sour. 7 people to attack a Soviet base housing hundreds of Russians. 7 against thieves, he said to himself. 6, really. All we've got going for us is surprise. Maybe it'll be enough. Maybe. If not, a sudden lurching feeling. "Retro rockets," and Njombe's bass voice rang. "We're on the way in." Dan looked at the luminous numerals of the watch on his wrist, then turned on his helmet light to study the schedule taped just above it. On schedule. The astronauts floated down to the floor of the big empty chamber. Strange, Dan thought, how even the slightest pull of gravity brings back all your earthbound concepts of up, down, floor, ceiling. Tensely, they sat on the grimy metal plates, silent now, waiting for the final thump of landing. Several times they felt staggering lurches as the retro rockets fired brief pulses. "Sloppy work," Elger muttered. But with only the moon's gentle gravity to contend with, the bursts of thrust were small, light, almost trivial. Dan turned his suit radio to the frequency used by Luna Grot's ground controllers, but nothing more than a hiss of static penetrated the spherical shell of the freighter. A final surge of thrust made him feel almost heavy, and then the craft thumped once and became still. For an instant, none of the 6 moved. Dan felt the old familiar tug of the moon's gravity. He got to his feet carefully, remembering that he weighed only 1/6 of his normal weight on Earth. And Njombe, who had never been on the moon before, overdid it and bounded upward like a giant frog. But he had time to get his legs straightened and landed on his feet in a lunar slow motion. "Terrific," somebody said. "Can you do Swan Lake?" "Just be careful," Dan cautioned. "You've all worked in zero-G. Don't let the feeling of weight fool you. We're not on Earth." Slowly, almost hesitantly, they clumped across the metal floor plates to the man-sized hatch. The entire freighter could split open like a giant egg when it was being loaded with cargo. Dan's information, obtained over several years of carefully cultivated contacts around the world, was that the standard procedure at Luna Grot was to send an inspection team out to the newly landed freighter to check it out before loading it with a new shipment of ores. But how long before the inspection team gets here? He wondered. Minutes or hours? And a voice in his head asked, or days? It seemed like hours, but only 12 minutes had elapsed on Dan's wristwatch when they heard the hatch being opened. The interior of the freighter was an airless vacuum, just as the lunar surface outside. But Dan could feel the vibrations of the hatch's mechanism working through the soles of his booted feet, coming up from the deck plates. The others heard it, too. They flattened out along the curving bulkhead on either side of the hatch. 2 men in spacesuits stepped inside, the lamps on their helmets throwing pools of light into the dark interior of the cargo hold.
"She's the best lay in Curatum," Dan heard one of them saying over the suit-to-suit radio frequency.
That's what you say.
Their conversation never got any further.